Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. We'll be talking a lot about functional medicine this hour, and also, starting off, just to kick off our discussions, we're going to talk about something that's both simultaneously news of the weird and news of a really cool thing, and that is new evidence supporting the presence of bacteria in the placenta. Now, you know those probiotics? They're everywhere, it turns out. They're in your eyeball, in your ear, in your nose, in your throat, in your gums, in your gut, and just about any place you can imagine. We know that they come out in breast milk. That was a surprise. Imagine the journey from the inside of the intestine into breast milk. It's quite a little trip, but that's not what we're going to talk about tonight. We're going to talk about the verification that there are living bacteria in the placenta, and that they've been reported using metagenomics or microbiome sequencing, and that's something where you could potentially have contamination. After all, they are coming out, from the body and being put in a tray. And, you know, maybe you could argue that they could have gotten contaminated. So this is the proof that it's actually within the microarchitecture, not on the outside or surface. And they used amplified 16S universal in situ hybridization designed for bacterial RNA, and a couple of other methods as well that are more histologic. And they saw differences in how the bacteria were distributed in the placenta depending upon whether this was a term baby or a preterm baby. Now, this is really important, folks, because the causes of preterm labor are really very mysterious, and yet the results of being born premature are extremely dangerous, both for the mom, but especially for the baby. And so if we could find what's going on, and is it related to bacterial infection? That's been hypothesized for a long time. Maybe this isn't quite an infection. Maybe it's a colonization. And it looks like the preterm placenta have different kinds of microbes, and that they are located in different places, in different layers within the placenta. So these low bacterial communities are playing a role in shaping the developing immune system in the fetus, or at least that's a hypothesis. What role things like mom's diet and preterm birth may play in this interaction, this dance between the bacteria and our own human cells, is yet to be determined, but that there is something going on and that it's different in preterm babies is extremely exciting news, because there may be a preventative method coming through here, and that would be extraordinarily cool. Well, you heard it here first, regular listeners at least will have heard it here first, and that's my caution about the keto diet. So this comes out of the University of British Columbia, and it's talking about the cheat day. Now, usually people say, well, you know, if you're on a diet, you know, one day out of seven, you can go ahead and cheat. But the ketogenic diet, this is a really bad idea. Even just 75 grams of glucose, that's, you know, about 250 calories, give or take. So after a seven-day high-fat, low-carbohydrate diet, your body has shifted. And we're talking about a diet that's maybe 70% fat, 10% carbs, and 20% protein, so a true ketogenic diet. And what they found was that when you give sugar to people who've made that biological shift, there's a great deal of inflammatory response in the blood vessels themselves. So this is super important for those of you who are trying to go keto. The message is, you just can't cheat. If you're going to do it, do it well, and don't cheat. You can't just go and have a cookie. You can't just go and have a Coke or say, oh, yeah, whatever. If you're going to have a birthday party, you need to taper yourself off the keto diet and gradually introduce more and more sugar or carbs over several days to get the physiologic adjustment out of there, because it's really like giving a massive sunburn to the inside of your vascular bed if you push sugar after your body has switched over to this keto diet. So you might have heard last week discussion a little bit about a woman who could smell a change in her husband's sweat, and this predicted the development of Parkinson's disease. This was a woman who had a very acute nose and smelled lots of interesting things, but she later discovered that she could smell Parkinson's disease in anybody's sweat, and the researchers are now trying to narrow it down to figure out exactly what she's smelling, what chemical, and they've identified like four things, just to review the story with you. And they think they can maybe program the new computerized nose to sniff out Parkinson's disease. Well, that artificial nose is actually being used to help identify cancerous tissue during surgery and allowing a more precise and careful excision of tumors. This comes from the University of Tampere, and I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, in Finland. Maybe it's Tampere. Anyway, however they say it, they have been looking at surgical smoke to help with neurosurgery. So currently, when we resect a brain tumor, we're using a device called an electrocautery device, and that causes tissue to coagulate. It burns it, basically, and causes it to release a little bit of smoke. Normally, what we have to do when we're trying to remove a cancer and not take out any more brain tissue than we have to is we'll take out a piece and send it off for what's called frozen section. The slice of tissue is dipped in liquid nitrogen, and then the pathologist, who is literally sitting at his or her microscope waiting for the tissue specimen, looks at it and says, yes, we're in normal tissue, or no, there's still cancer here. And if the answer is there's still more cancer here, they make another slice until finally you've got normal tissue. In this case, there is a little smoke detector instrument that sucks out the smoke, and then it runs it through a device called a differential mobility spectrometer. And I'm just going to read this without understanding it, because I don't understand this. Flue gas ions are fed into an electric field. The distribution of the ions in the electric field is tissue specific, and the tissue can be identified on the basis of an odor fingerprint. And in this case, using a machine learning system and backing it up with frozen section, the machine learning system was able to identify the tumor fingerprint, odor fingerprint, and it really got fairly accurate. So it was 97% sensitive and 90% specific in looking at gliomas, and these are gliomas to control samples. So the machine needs a little bit more work. When they took it across all cancers, it was only 83% accurate. So I'm still going to want that backup frozen section before I close as the surgeon. But nevertheless, this is an extraordinarily interesting piece of technology. And the concept of the machine learning being able to, over time, with teaching, identify patterns that otherwise we are not able to discover using standard scientific method is a true game changer in ways that, well, just like the internet, remember when you used to text with just a keypad and now you open up the phone and watch a movie? Well, folks, that happened in about 15 years. So check in on this technology in 15 years. And this smelling with machine learning of everything. And who knows, we may have crime scene detection being done by just taking an odor signature of the off-gassing, shall we say, that the guy who robbed the bank did. Anyway, be on the lookout. There could be an all-points bulletin on that near you. Also related to Parkinson's disease, I guess we're having a lot of internal associations today, because when I went through the articles I'd pull, I thought, oh, well, that fits with that, and this fits with that. So we actually have a coordinated flow today. Microbes eat our medication. This has been known for a while that the gut microbes actually ferment and change things. I mean, we know about sourdough bread, right? The bacteria cause the bread to rise. We know about fermented vegetables like kimchi and sauerkraut. We know that when you take onions and saute them slowly, they turn sweet. Well, these are chemical reactions that happen that, you know, are related to what the microbes in our gut are able to do. So, of course, our microbes in our gut help us absorb nutrients. They make vitamin K, for example. They help us with a number of nutrients that we have a hard time digesting otherwise. And the fiber that we eat, which we cannot digest, the product of that digesting by the microbes is actually an important food source for our own colon cells. So the fiber, it's like, oh, well, we can't absorb this. The bacteria go, well, I sure can. Here, let me ferment that for you. Those fermentation products, called short-chain fatty acids, are then eaten by our own colon bacteria. In other words, our guts would become very unhealthy if we didn't have the probiotics actually making their food. They would be starving to death, the gut cells, if the probiotics didn't help feed them. So we've known that microbial metabolism occurs with drugs, and we've also known that drugs get broken down, and sometimes they get broken down in weird ways. A good example of this is the drug that we make in our ovaries and adrenal glands called estrogen. So estrogen gets complexed with bile salts to get rid of it in the body. There are certain bacteria who make an enzyme called beta-glucuronidase, so they eat the chemical bond between our bile salt and the estrogen, and the estrogen is released, at which point it's no longer becomes lipid soluble. That is to say, it can soak across the abdominal wall and get back into the circulation and be recycled. And we'll have an email coming up in a little bit where I think that is exactly one of the things going wrong with a woman with endometriosis. So getting back to the story of the drugs, there's something really important in Parkinson's disease called L-DOPA or levodopa. It's the primary treatment. And there are bacteria that degrade this drug in the gut. So Parkinson's disease happens when the cells that produce dopamine in the brain are damaged by an inflammatory process thought to be autoimmune. Increased levels of mercury and lead exposure throughout your lifetime increase your risk. There's also genetic risks. The body has a hard time moving when you have Parkinson's disease, and also balance and coordination happen. So we treat that by giving dopamine orally in the form of L-DOPA, but only about 1 to 5% of L-DOPA actually gets to the brain. And the body's enzyme break down L-DOPA in the gut as well as bacteria. So they introduced a drug called carbidopa, which blocked our human guts from breaking down the L-DOPA. That way the L-DOPA could get into the bloodstream and then get into the brain. But it turns out that in some people it still isn't very effective. And it's because while the carbidopa blocks our enzymes that break down L-DOPA, it doesn't block the enzymes that certain bacteria use to eat the L-DOPA. A lot of these enzymes convert L-DOPA into tyrosine, which is a basic building block, an amino acid, but it's the basic building block for dopamine. And There's a food microbe that's often found in milk and pickles. It's called Lactobacillus brevis. It's considered to be a probiotic, but it encodes for an enzyme that can break down L-DOPA. But the real criteria, the big one that has the most breakdown, is something called Enterococcus faecalis. And this is not a probiotic, but it is a very powerful eater, like a little Pac-Man that just goes through and destroys the L-DOPA so that it gets converted back to tyrosine, and it is therefore inactivated. So the concept here of these interactions between the microorganisms in our gut and the drugs that we take is very much in its infancy. But the fact is that the bacteria, as they eat the L-DOPA, they convert it into something called metatyronine. And some researchers think that most of the bad side effects of L-DOPA, and there are plenty of GI side effects as well as other side effects that are unpleasant and limit dosing, might be related to colonization by L. faecalis. So what do we need to do? We need to do one of those 16S RNA studies, look at L. faecalis, see if we see that particular 16S RNA, and then go after it with something that discourages it or replaces it in the gut. I predict we'll be doing gut microbiome surgery in the not too distant future. In fact, of course, we're already doing that to cure Clostridium difficile, and there's work right now, still experimental, but very much in what we call stage 3 human trials, treating ulcerative colitis. Our real problem is going to be growing enough of the right poop to do the fecal transplants that are coming up on the horizon. What do you think? Let me have, one more microbiome, please. This one's quick. It's about yogurt. Menshevik, I think is his name, won a Nobel Prize over 100 years ago for suggesting that yogurt might help prevent cancer. Well, it's taken about 100 years to prove it, a little bit more perhaps. But this was a study, data mining, the health professionals follow-up study. This had 32,000 men and 55,000 women, and they were all nurses. And all of them had lower bowel endoscopy looking between 1986 and 2012. And every 4 years, they provided a lifestyle and diet questionnaire. So during that time, there were 5,800 adenomas, which are a precancerous lesion, showing up in the men's colon, and 8,000 in the women's colon. With men who didn't eat yogurt, comparing with those who ate two or more servings of yogurt a week, there was about a 20% decrease in the frequency of adenomas and a 25% decrease in the dangerous-looking adenomas. And so that was kind of cool. Yogurt seemed to have a substantial effect. Now, this is a large number study, so it's probably a true clinical effect. And you just have to ask yourself if a 25% reduction in precancerous lesion is worth choking down a couple servings of yogurt a week. That was two servings a week, in case I misspoke. They don't know why. It's just an epidemiological study and association. Remember, these were free-range humans, so they might have been eating yogurt because they thought it was healthy, and they could have been doing something else because they thought it was healthy. It's still circumstantial evidence, but good evidence at that. So I want to give a shout-out to Pat, who caught me in an error. So when I write my book, Pat will get a free signed copy. Remember I said that, Pat? But right now we're going to talk about golden rice. And I misspoke when I was talking about GMO in a recent show. I said that that golden rice had more lysine in it. That was an error. It was actually vitamin A that the golden rice had. And the idea is that because people who have a diet high in rice, and sometimes that's all they eat, become deficient in vitamin A, that this was a strategy to try and rectify that problem. She provided me with a recent article from June 5th, that showed that the FDA had recently actually tested the current version of golden rice. It's gone through quite a lot of iterations. Basically, the latest version has two enzymes that help make beta carotene. One comes from corn and one comes from bacteria. And a third is a selectable marker, which is used to just say, okay, we got it in there. We can use these cells. And what the FDA did was they looked at how much beta carotene is being made and is it really meaningful. Now, it has been approved all over the world, and it is now funded by the Gates Foundation. And the FDA said, you know, we're not going to authorize this for release in the United States because it just doesn't make enough vitamin A, and they gave some comparisons. So you get around 1.6 micrograms per gram for beta carotene. The latest study said 1.26, but let's call it around 1.5. And a carrot has 13 to 50 micrograms, so, you know, more than 10 times. Asian greens have 20 to 66 micrograms per gram. Spinach has 100. And so you could make the argument, let them eat spinach. I'm not sure that's viable in all of the third world. And I'm wondering if, they said that to receive an adequate amount of beta carotene, you would have to eat almost 4 kilograms of golden rice a day, which is clearly well above the level that someone would need to consume. But I'm thinking that an adequate amount of beta carotene might be the amount that is considered the RDA by the FDA. And I will just comment that I'm not sure that this article completely destroys the concept that the golden rice might be viable in preventing blindness, because even a little bit of vitamin A goes preferentially to the eyeballs to make the pigmented compounds that are the rhodopsin, which is used to help you see. So those pigmented compounds use retinoic acid or vitamin A, and I believe that that's the first place that the body puts them. So I'm not certain of that, and if someone can prove me wrong, you will get a free signed copy of my, at this point, vaporware book. Thank you very much, Pat, for that assistance with keeping the record straight. We'll next go to an email from Dan in Pittsburgh. And Dan writes, post-anemia gastric bypass. My wife had a gastric bypass surgery 4 years ago. She's lost a lot of weight, about 130 pounds, but she's having problems with anemia. She keeps taking iron pills and they don't seem to absorb. She keeps eating beef and it doesn't seem to be helping. Things like that. Is there anything else that she can do to get help? She goes to a hematology clinic once every other week to get injections of iron. So that's a big deal and quite a hassle, and Daniel's looking for some ways to help. So let's take a moment and talk about gastric bypass surgery. Effectively, what you're doing in most of these surgeries, and there are several different versions, but I'll try to speak in generalities, is that you are making the stomach much, much smaller. And in doing that, you are also impairing any of the part of digestion that the stomach is responsible for. So, for example, the stomach is supposed to store a large meal, secrete a bunch of acid, and then kind of pump itself around, mush and squish and churn to break down the food particles such that they are in small, tiny little fragments by the time they get to the small intestine. Surface to volume, right? If you want to dissolve salt if you want to make salt water, it's really great if you take granulated salt and put it in hot water. If you take one of those Himalayan sea salt chunks and put it in boiling water, because the water's only in contact with the surface of that big rock, it's going to take a very long time for that water to taste salty. And so if you imagine that the poor small intestine is having to break down a chunk of meat, There's not much of the iron that's sitting inside the cells of that meat that's necessarily going to be absorbed. So first of all, you want as much mechanical breakdown on any beef that she eats as possible. And I'm talking about potted meat, running it through a grinder and getting it to a paste consistency. And that doesn't have the mouthfeel. If she is going to try to break it down with her teeth, she better have very good teeth, and she better chew about 50 times before she swallows each bite in order to break it down sufficiently to replace what the stomach does completely under our radar as far as digestion. The second problem is acid production. Because she only has, let's say a sixth of the stomach, she's not got a very high level of acid-producing cells that can contribute to getting the pH down on what you've eaten. And a lot of people have pH problems anyway. And when you go through this surgery, you can mush the vagus nerve, you can affect gastric emptying, and you can affect the process of digestion in a really fundamental way that messes up the enzymes downstream. So she may not be making enough acid. So these are two things that you can do right away, is when she's eating meat and also when she's taking iron. I have some suggestions there. You're going to want to add stomach acid. You can do this in the form of maybe a quarter cup of apple cider vinegar. That's a lot of apple cider vinegar. If you dilute it in 8 ounces of water, it's a little easier to take. You can also buy stomach acid in capsules. I'd recommend starting at about 3,000 milligrams of betaine hydrochloride, which is basically hydrochloric acid, and see how much she can take without getting heartburn. And that's her dose. These are some basic functional medicine strategies to help with the stomach breakdown piece of things. It's important to understand that if the vagus nerve or the emptying gets messed up, then the production of other enzymes in the small intestine may be impaired. And there are alternative testing, functional testing, stool studies that can tell you whether you're making enough pancreatic juice and tell you whether the pancreas is functioning properly. If that's not happening, adding pancreatic or digestive enzymes can also be helpful in breaking down things so that the nutrients can be absorbed. Other nutrients besides iron that are a big problem are B12, especially because B12 requires both acid and a special compound called intrinsic factor that is made, guess what, in the stomach. So her B12 levels need to be monitored, and she should have a B12 level above the mid-range at all times, and her doctor should be checking that, but make sure the hematologist is doing so. This is something that I find that kind of people just forget. They know it. If you give them a multiple choice test, they'll check the box and be correct and get their board certification. But when it comes to actually remembering that when they're looking at a person, it's easy to forget. And I've seen it be a problem. The other thing is calcium. Also requires acid. Also a problem. I've seen lots of osteoporosis in people who are 5 to 10 years out from their gastric bypass. So by all means, before she gets another problem, please have her get a bone scan and have her bone breakdown markers, which can be checked in her urine, have those looked at and make sure she's not burning through bone. Now, I said I'd give you some other suggestions, and this is a particular type of vitamin C called Arceola vitamin C. And this is what comes in the rose hips. So you can buy it, but the regular vitamin C doesn't work when it comes to this iron utilization issue that she's having. So rose hips vitamin C, pretty big doses. So we're talking maybe 1,000 milligrams taken at the same time with her iron. And while we're on the subject of iron, the usual iron, ferrous gluconate, is not as absorbable. It's a bit cheaper, but it's not compared to going in for an iron infusion every 2 weeks and the cost of that, the extra cost to purchase ferrous fumarate, F-U-M-E-R-A-T-E, that particular form of iron, and you should get it as a liquid, which can be compounded. Again, break it down, make it already semi-liquid so that the system doesn't have to do the breakdown, because what has been amputated in your wife's case effectively is the front end of the digestive system, which is all about physical breakdown of whatever you put in your mouth. And she's clearly having problems with iron. My worry is she may be having problems with calcium, B12, and a host of other nutrients. So nutrient testing, which is not hard to do, should be done on an annual basis. And if she does need to take multivitamins or nutrients, they should be in a liquid form or a powdered form that you add to water. So I hope that that will be helpful. And I would love to hear back from you, Daniel, in Pittsburgh, if I have been able to make a difference for your wife, because honest to God, that's why I'm sitting here at, 6:35 on a Wednesday night talking to you, because I want to make everybody's life better. Okay, so I promised you an endometriosis question, and here it is. Richard from Detroit writes, endometriosis. My daughter has experienced general abdominal and lower back pain. They're now saying it is endometriosis. I would love to hear the functional medicine approach to treating this. Well, let's define our terms first. And so Richard probably knows this because he looked it up, but for all of you who don't necessarily know it, the inside of the uterus is lined with a very interesting tissue called endometrium. And endometrium is very heavy in stem cells, and it grows really fast. In fact, every month, a woman who's menstruating will grow about somewhere between 1/2 inch to 3/4 inch thick layer of endometrium, about as much as to cover a standard Bartlett pear. So take that Bartlett pear, dip it in a 1/2 inch thick layer of chocolate, scrape off the chocolate, and that's how much endometrium. That's a lot of tissue. That would be similar to if you had a 1/2 inch thick callus growing on the bottom of your feet every month. It takes a lot of energy. And like I said, there's lots of stem cells. Now, normally that's not a problem. Every month the woman has her period, the endometrium liquefies, comes out. We call that a menstruation, and you start over again. Problems occur when the endometrium actually falls out of the fallopian tube. So instead of falling out of the uterus and into the vagina, some of it gets squirted back into the abdominal cavity, because the fallopian tube is open to the abdominal cavity. It's a long, twisty opening, and there's a lot of things in there that prevent bacteria from the vagina from ever getting into the abdominal cavity. But it is an open door. And these stem cells can get loose in the abdominal cavity. They can find a place where there's a decent blood supply. And because they're stem cells, they go, oh, I'm supposed to grow endometrium. Oh, look, there's the estrogen. I'll just grow endometrium here where I've got a blood supply. And they do. They are like a tumor, but they're a tumor that's not cancerous. They're just responding to the signals that they are programmed to respond to in an inappropriate way. So up comes the estrogen. Then there's ovulation. And then when the period happens, the endometrium sloughs and releases blood like compounds into the intestine, which is incredibly irritating. Blood is really, really painful in there. And so you get an inflammatory response, you get pain response, and women suffer the periods from hell. And often in more advanced cases, they'll also have problems with their bowel. They'll have blockages. Sometimes things will twist on themselves. They can end up with rectal bleeding. They can get endometrium on their cervix. They can get endometria on their kidneys. And then they urinate blood during their periods because the kidneys are involved. So this is a really drastic disease. It's normally treated either with surgery or with drugs that block the formation of all of the sex hormones. So you basically put someone into an artificial menopause and turn off their estrogen. With no estrogen, the endometrium goes into hibernation and stays there. Sometimes we can treat it with just continuous birth control pills, and that's enough to keep the stuff quiet and keep it from causing pain. But obviously, it's going to interfere with getting pregnant, and this happens a lot to young women who do want to start a family and are prevented from doing so. In functional medicine terms, we think of endometriosis as inappropriate signaling. Because we are big picture people and we think in terms of signaling, we're going to want to look at estrogen levels. We're going to think of that. We think of this in a very similar way than we think of polycystic ovary disease, where the signaling for this complex process, the software's gotten scrambled. The wrong signals are being sent at the wrong time and the wrong things are happening. So what we want to do is try and lower estrogen, because usually high levels of estrogen are at the root of the problem. Fixing the microbiome is key. Remember I was talking about the beta-glucuronidase enzyme? When I've looked at bowel testing in women for that in women with endometriosis, I have yet to find someone who doesn't have high levels of this enzyme. So their body's not getting rid of their estrogen. And so the first thing to do is get the person pooping twice a day, get their gut cleaned up, make sure that they don't have high levels of beta-glucuronidase, and fix it if they do. Start them on a detoxification program. And often what that means in the case of estrogen is lots of sulfur-containing foods, lots of broccoli, crucifers in general. I'm a great fan of broccoli sprouts as a food because it's the most it's more abundant in sprouts, and sprouts are easy to eat, and you can throw them in a smoothie, and you can eat a cup of broccoli sprouts a day. You can also buy extracts, sulforaphane, which is a company called Thorn makes a product called Crucera. But sulforaphane is something I've talked about on the air before. It's a very efficient estrogen detoxifier. But don't forget pooping. And that's super important. And you want two good formed bowel movements a day, or you're not getting enough fiber, and you keep taking fiber and magnesium and more fiber until you get that, and more fluid until you get that going on. And sometimes it does require a lot of probiotic surgery. I also like saunas. I like exercise. Exercise is very helpful in all sorts of detoxification, because as you raise your muscle content, you drop your insulin resistance. And unfortunately, it seems to me like lately, like every other young person I test has mild insulin resistance. And I think, you know, there's a lot of speculation about what's causing that, but it almost doesn't matter at this point, because if that's what's going on, we need to address it and worry about causes later, because we've got a damaged generation on our hands that needs help, and we should be using it. So a long answer to a fairly brief email, but I wanted also to take a moment and talk about xenoestrogens. I alluded to that briefly, but there's lots of things, BPA, phthalates, lots of things in plastic, but also lots of things in pesticides. Things in the fire retardants, things in the foam rubber in your old sofa that gives a little puff of dust every time you sit in it. These are things that actually can hit the estrogen receptors, and worse yet, they can slow down the processing of estrogen because they crowd the detoxification pathway. So that's where sweating is extremely helpful, because it produces an additional detoxification pathway. So I hope I've given you some ideas of how helpful a functional medicine physician would be for your daughter. And since you're out there in Detroit, I would go to functionalmedicine.org and put in your zip code and look for people who are certified. Certified functional medicine physicians have gone through an extensive training program and know how to do this, because I'm part of the teaching program that teaches this, and we teach it. So if they've gone through all the courses and they've done the hormonal module and they've done the AFMCP and they've done their other modules and passed their board exam, you know, for one thing, at the moment they took that multiple choice board exam, they had the entire endocrine pathway in their brains, because that's on the test. So they know what they're talking about and they know what they're doing, and they can help you and your daughter. So I hope you'll reach out to an appropriate person. Richard in Boca Raton. I'm not sure if that's your first year last name, so if I got it backwards, sorry. Commenting on 5G. So, Richard, I am working on a big story on 5G. I'm working on an entire show dedicated to that. So stay tuned. I will get back to you on that. Also, to Ronnie, who doesn't tell me where he's from. Local, 95062, so somewhere in Santa Cruz. Yes, Ronnie, I agree. Schizophrenia is a national emergency. We have very little understanding beyond the fact that there's about a 1% population prevalence of schizophrenia, which is pretty high for a disease that we're doing our best to ignore. We do have treatment, but the treatments have side effects, and we're constantly working on better ones. But because of the side effects, many people walk around untreated. And at least in my community of Santa Cruz, many of the people who are without a place to live are people who have serious schizophrenic issues. And that makes them unable to problem solve at the level of other people. Sometimes parts of their brain are larger than others, as you remarked in your email. But it seems to be the balance of the connections and how the connections work rather than any physical difference in the size or shape of the brain. We definitely do see differences in brain activity that shift when we get the person on a good medication, and the size of the brain differentials actually change over time when people stay on their medications, but they never stop needing them. We are not curing this disease, and we need to be looking for a cure. We also have not found a good diagnostic gene test that tells us who's at risk. Diane in Saginaw, Michigan writes, psoriasis and dental issues. My 31-year-old daughter has had psoriasis since age 10. My 28-year-old daughter also has it, and I have it. Both daughters are on Cosentyx with good results. I'm on Otezla with good results. But my problem isn't with the 31-year-old. Despite meticulous oral hygiene, she has had numerous dental issues, root canals, tooth infections, extractions, implants, and gum grafts, and she's only 31. She's now facing two implants, another gum graft, and periodic deep cleaning. The oral surgeon stated that psoriasis has taken up resident in her mouth. She's fit, eats a good diet consisting of many vegetables. She's had periodic inflammation in her knees and a very sluggish GI tract. Is there anything you could recommend? Well, as a systems thinker and a family physician and a functional physician, I'm thinking sluggish GI tract equals, for me, with that diet, it equals bad bacteria. She doesn't have a good microbiome. She may not have a good microbiome because she's got huge amounts of dangerous alpha strep and gamma strep growing in her mouth. And whenever she swallows any saliva, she's seeding this strep into her gut. So doing a stool analysis, doing that 16S bacterial RNA to see what species are down there and whether her prevalences are normal, I doubt it. She definitely needs gut work. That's regardless of what the source is. But I suspect that the primary dysbiosis is in her mouth. If she gets psoriasis on her tongue or on the inside of her cheeks or on her gums, psoriasis causes inflammation. That's been established. The inflammation should be blocked by the drug. But what's going on? Why is she still having all this psoriasis? And I think what's going on is that the bacteria that are in her mouth are inflammatory bacteria. It's just like the ulcer bacteria in your stomach. It makes you make more stomach acid. So too much stomach acid at the wrong times creates ulcers. H. pylori likes acid, and it stimulates your own cells to produce more acid. Well, if you have a colony of bacteria in your mouth that likes inflammation, they're going to stimulate inflammation. And despite the anti-inflammatory drugs, which very well may be broken down in the mouth by the bacteria, at this point, we can't say one way or another about that, but it's certainly a possibility, she's not getting what she needs. So first of all, there are mouth probiotics out there. and talk to your dentist. It's probably in his dental magazine, and he or she's probably rolled their eyes and say, oh, so bogus. But there are dental probiotics. Go get some. Start using them. But on top of that, I want you to get a soft catheter and a syringe. It's a little rubber thing that fits on the tip of a syringe. And you're going to get curcumin and CoQ10 in liquid form. And I can find both of those products at Costco in a liquid form. It's kind of a thick liquid, maybe the consistency of ketchup. And you're going to want to fill the syringe, put the catheter on, and actually squirt. It's tedious, but I would squirt a mixture. I would squirt CoQ10 and curcumin, and I don't think I would mix them because I'm not sure they play well together. So maybe in the morning you would do a curcumin, and just all of the gum, all the areas where the gums are inflamed or irritated, you just run a bead of curcumin along the edge of the gum, inside and outside of the mouth. In the night you do the CoQ10. I think this could be really, really helpful. It's anti-inflammatory, and it reduces reactive oxygen species. And what that's going to do is that's going to reduce the damage that's being done to the tissues. So between the CoQ10 putting out the fire and the curcumin preventing the fire from getting rolling, we've got a really, really effective strategy that I encourage you to try. And I will emphasize, you have absolutely nothing to lose by doing this except time, and you'll see results right away. So we're going to go to Kelly in Santa Cruz. Hello, you should be on the air. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you. So I have a weird problem. I was out and about, and all of a sudden I had this absolute shooting pain in my shin, like somebody literally stuck a needle in my shin. And it was so intense for about 20 seconds that I thought, oh, my God, I'm not going to be able to stand up anymore. And I've had it about 10 times in the last couple of weeks.
Never had it before this?
I've never had it before this.
All right.
I talked to a friend of mine who's an acupuncturist, and she said, that's blood stagnation in Chinese medicine.
Maybe.
But I just thought I'd get your take.
Well, yes, it could be blood stagnation. The next question out of my mouth was going to be any differential swelling in the foot. So is the shoe on that side tighter?
No.
Okay. So I'm not worried about a vein blockage or a blood clot, a partial blood clot in the veins in the back of your leg leading to distension of the tissues. And you tell me a little bit about your activities, and what were you doing the very first time you had this? But tell me, are you a jogger? Do you run
I'm
on the
walker.
Beach? You're a walker.
I walk a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, I was walking. I was actually in a crowded art show, and I was walking. When it happened.
Were you wearing flats?
Yeah.
Okay. And had you been doing any, like walking uphill in the previous few minutes?
No, nothing weird.
Okay, nothing weird. All right, so I'm thinking it might be first of all, shin splints comes to mind, and that's where the basically the attachments of the muscle, the tibialis anterior that lifts your toe and lifts your foot when you're walking. So when you basically walk on your heels, mm-hmm. you're using that muscle. So and when you're walking fast, or when sometimes that'll fatigue out, or you'll get effectively a stress fracture. Imagine a tree, and the tree has all of its roots down, and the roots aren't going to hold the tree in the wind. But if there's a really strong wind, it might start to pull the roots loose. You know, on the mm-hmm. Winds on the windward side. And mm-hmm. the soil would crack a little bit, and maybe the tree would be, you could kind of pull on the root and see it move a bit. And that's essentially how the tendon goes into the bone. So if you get that kind of an injury, it can cause a really sharp pain. The muscle itself is in a tight compartment. So if you run your finger along the bone, along the tibia, mm-hmm. really, you know, oil it up, put some lotion or something on, and run it really slowly from the bottom to the top, and see if there's like a really a sore spot that's like much sore.
Mm-hmm. there's no, I mean, I'm doing it right now. There's no, you know, if the shooting pain, I would call it it was like a stabbing pain more than shooting. If it's not happening, I feel absolutely normal.
Yeah, so there's nothing, and then run your...
No, now, there's nothing
okay,
there.
Okay, so next to the bone...
Ironically, my other leg, about a month ago, my knee swelled up a little bit with no injury or anything either, and there's been some pain there, but not shooting pain.
Right.
But that's the other leg.
Well, actually, it's the other leg, but it's, you know, if something goes into the right ear, it can... You know, it can definitely go to the other side of the brain fairly quickly. So there's a lot of crossing over that happens. And sometimes when something's hurting, we'll use different muscles and it'll change our walk. And then that'll change the other side. And the shoes were shoes that you'd had for a while. They aren't all broken down, but they aren't brand new.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, nothing abnormal was happening.
Yes, I'm getting that. Okay. And when you run your finger along the muscle, you know, just to the outside of the bone, there's the bones kind of almost like a sharp edge, and then there's the muscle, and that's also good?
Yeah, there's nothing different there.
Okay. Well, given the location of the pain, you'd probably want to look at treating the treating the meridians, and we'd probably treat the spleen meridian. And based on where you're describing the pain, there's some important, really important spleen points in that area. And if it is this chi stagnation or blood stagnation, that should make a difference. I would pay really close attention. However, I think there's clues that you haven't observed, and it may be, I may be wrong about this, but it won't hurt that every time it happens, you sort of think, okay, what have I done for the last 2 hours? When's the last time that I exercised? What shoes am I wearing? I'm really kind of cluing in on shoes because so often that's the problem, and it's a particular pair of shoes. Or
well, the first time it happened, when I was out, and other times that it's happened, and the pain has gotten way milder. So it's almost like it kind of happens, and it's like, oh, there it is. But it's like it's dialed down to a 2 instead of a 10. The other times that it's happened, I was just kind of sitting around. I wasn't doing anything.
Yeah, but that's why I want you to go back a couple of hours and just think about what happened before. We're going to have to close because we've come to the end of our hour. But
try those things.
You can call us back next week a little earlier in the hour, and we'll keep hammering away. But do some close observation. Bye-bye. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.